Hello, ladies and gentlemen, this is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover in this audio Psalms chapter 139. I will entitle the psalm, Search Me, O God, and Know My Heart. The heading to the psalm says, To the Choir Master, a Psalm of David. So this was obviously sung by a Levitical choir at some point in the time of David, assuming the heading is accurate, and I will assume that. So David, we will assume, is the author of the psalm. We start now in verses 1 through 4. David begins, O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You understand my thought from afar. You scrutinize my path and my lying down, and are intimately acquainted with all my ways. Even before there is a word on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you know it all. Now in verse 1, David says, God, you've searched me. As the NIV Study Bible says, God knows the true personalities, the secret fantasies, and the hidden motives of the human heart. Jeremiah 17:9 says, The heart is more deceitful than all else and is desperately sick. Who can understand it? Self-deception is the common lot of mankind. David was self-deceived just like everybody else was, but he says, But God, you've searched me and you know me. He's not deceived. God's not deceived about David's heart. The unknown author of Psalms 1, verse 6 says this, For the Lord knows the way of the righteous. He knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. So, David starts out by saying, God, you've checked me out. You know me. I've got nothing to hide before you. He emphasizes that main thought in verse 2. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. Why? Well, because God's omniscient. He knows everything. You understand my thought from afar, even though you might be a long way off from me in heaven, you still understand what I'm thinking. Verse 3, you scrutinize my path. That's what David does in the daytime. And you scrutinize my lying down. That's what David does in the nighttime. Day and night, you're there, God. You are intimately acquainted with all my ways. Even before I say a word, before there's a word on my tongue, you know what I'm going to say. So that's a very poetic, very effective way of saying God knows everything about David. So he continues in verses 5 and 6. David says, You, God, have enclosed me behind and before, and laid your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is too high. I cannot attain to it. Now in verse 5, when David says, You have enclosed me, other translations have, You have beset me, KJV. The Holman Christian Study Bible says, You have encircled me. And the NIV says, You have hemmed me in. Well, that sort of sounds negative. To hem someone in is an expression today to convey a feeling of confinement, as the NIV Study Bible says. But the meaning of the psalm is opposite. David was grateful for God's close contact. Wherever he turned, he found God. So this is a good thing, David's saying. You're in front of me and you're behind me and you've laid your hand upon me. Again, not in a negative way, not to punish David. But as John Gill says, God's hand was a hand of power and providence to preserve, protect, and defend David. Verse 6, such knowledge is too wonderful for me. There's two ways you can look at that knowledge. Option number one, that could be knowledge of the psalmist himself that God had. Such knowledge of me is too wonderful for me. Such knowledge that you, God, have of me, David, is too wonderful for me. That's option one. Option number two is the knowledge that the psalmist had that God had enclosed him. Such knowledge that you have encircled me with your protection, such knowledge that I have is too wonderful for me, David says. I prefer the first option. I believe the knowledge that the psalmist David is referring to is the knowledge that God has of David. He spent four verses talking about it, and I think he's still talking about it in verse 6. That knowledge is too high. David cannot get there. He can't understand it. We go now to verses 7 and 8 of Psalms 139, and David continues, Where can I go from your spirit? Spirit is capitalized in the NASB because it's referring to the Holy Spirit. Where can I go from your spirit, David says, or where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, behold, you are there. First question is why would David want to flee from God? He just finished saying that he was happy that God had encircled him, had enclosed him. Why would he want to flee? The NIV Study Bible suggests two options. Option number one, David didn't flee. He was just asking a rhetorical question designed to show God's omnipotence. In other words, where can anybody go to flee from your spirit? Where can I go? It's impossible. Or it could be that David had sinned at some point, and he's saying, where can I go from your spirit? I can't hide. You know I sinned. I can't hide it. I'm really not sure what he's talking about here. He could be talking about his sin. But whether he is or isn't, it doesn't make any difference. The point is God is omniscient. He knows everything, and he is omnipresent. He is everywhere. David amplifies on God's omnipresence in verse 8. He says, if I ascend to heaven, you're there. If I make my bed in Sheol, behold, you're there. Heaven is high, Sheol is low, the underworld and the afterlife, or it could just be the grave, doesn't make any difference. High and low, God's there. Sheol generally means the place of the dead. There is no implication about reward or punishment. In other words, no idea of hell, really. Other ways to translate Sheol is a vast grave. This is from the NIV Study Bible. A vast grave, a stronghold, a wasteland, even a beast of prey. Let's just take it as a grave or the underworld. Somewhere that you go to when you're dead. Your physical body goes to the grave when you're dead. Your soul goes to the shadowy afterlife when you're dead. It doesn't make any difference. God's there. God's in heaven. God's there. Behold, you are there. Now, one interesting little point here. The word presence in verse 7, where can I go from your spirit or where can I flee from your presence? That word presence in the Hebrew is plural. Presences, which of course we don't have in English. Adam Clark comments on that. Why do we meet with this word so frequently in the plural number when applied to God? And why have we his spirit and his appearances or faces both here? A Trinitarian would at once say, the plurality of persons in the Godhead is intended. And who can prove that he is mistaken? So in verse 7, David says, where can I go from your spirit? There's one person of the Trinity, and then where can I flee from your presence? That would be your presences. That would refer to another person of the Trinity, the Godhead. Well, that to me is a Trinitarian verse I've never seen before. I'm not sure whether it really ought to be used in order to prove the Trinity. There's so many other verses you can easily do that, but it is interesting. We go now to Psalms 139, verses 9 through 12, and David continues, if I take the wings of the dawn, if I dwell in the remotest part of the sea, even there your hand will lead me, and your right hand will lay hold of me. If I say, surely the darkness will overwhelm me, and the light around me will be night, even the darkness is not dark to you, and the night is as bright as the day. Darkness and light are alike to you. David is still talking about God's omnipresence here. He says, if I take the wings of the dawn, that refers to the sun rising in the east, contrasted to the sea in the west. If I take the wings of the dawn, if I dwell in the remotest part of the sea, remember the sea in the scripture is the Mediterranean Sea, which is to the west of Israel. As John Gill says, the sea is often in scripture put for the west, the Mediterranean Sea being to the west of the land of Palestine. Wings of the dawn, that means as dawn is getting ready to take off, which is a poetic way of saying the sun is rising in the east. In fact, the Holman Christian Study Bible translates this in a very prosaic way. If I live at the eastern horizon or settle at the western limits. That is a poor translation, in my humble opinion. It's very rare that I ever say that the NASB is a better translation than the Holman Christian Study Bible, but in this case, I prefer the NASB. If I take the wings of the dawn, if I dwell in the remotest part of the Mediterranean Sea, the wings of the dawn of the east, sun comes up over the desert, over the Arabian desert, over Israel, and then even if I were there, God is there in the east, or if I was in the west where the sea is, God's there. He's omnipresent. Even there, your hand will lead me, he says in verse 10. The word there refers to the Mediterranean Sea. If I dwell in the remotest part of the sea, into verse 9, verse 10, even there, the remotest part of the sea, the Mediterranean Sea, your hand will lead me, and your right hand will lay hold of me. And of course, the right hand is the hand of power and security, strength, protection. Also, he mentions hand as an object of guidance. And of course, God doesn't have a hand. He's not a body. This is speaking anthropomorphically. So God will lead him wherever he is. And God's right hand will lay hold of David. That doesn't mean to punish him or to restrain him, but it means to protect him. Now, David has been talking about God's omnipresence for a while. And now in verse 11, he switches to God's omniscience. If I say, surely the darkness will overwhelm me, and the light around me will be night. Even the darkness is not dark to you. In other words, God knows everything, even though there's no light. Light, of course, symbolizes knowledge, because when the light bulb turns on, as we say, that means we understand it now. Light floods the darkness, and oh, I see things in the dark I didn't see before. So it talks about knowledge, this metaphor of light does. There is no darkness for God. He sees everything. There is no darkness to him. The darkness is not dark to you, David says. Job 34:21 says, for his eyes are upon the ways of a man, and he sees all his steps. David says in Psalms 139 here in verse 12, darkness and light are alike to you. There's no difference because there is no darkness with God. David moves now to Psalms 139 verses 13 through 16, and he continues, for you, God, formed my inward parts. You wove me in my mother's womb. I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and my soul knows it very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. Your eyes have seen my unformed substance, and in your book were all written the days that were ordained for me, when as yet there was not one of them. Verse 13, David says, you formed my inward parts. That's NESB translation, the Holman Christian Study Bible. And its marginal note says that literally the word there for inward parts is my kidneys. You have formed my kidneys. Well, that stands for all my organs, my inward parts, my inward organs. Now, why would David say that? Well, if God formed his organs, he obviously formed everything about him. It's just a strong way of saying every part of me was formed by you, God. The NIV for inward parts has my inward being. The KJV has an interesting translation. It says, for you possessed my reins. John Gill comments on that. His thoughts and counsels, the reins being the seat of instruction and counsel. Hence, God is called the trier of the reins and searcher of the hearts of the children of men. He is the possessor or master of their most secret thoughts and thoroughly knows them. Well, to me, that's getting a little far afield. I guess using that translation might get you there. The simplest way to look at this is God made David, end of story, outward and inward. He says in verse 13, you wove me in my mother's womb. Great verse if you're thinking about murdering a baby in abortion. That practice, which has now become very common in the United States of Sodom and Gomorrah, the same country which will moan and groan about what Adolf Hitler did, and then we do the same thing, but it doesn't matter. If David had been aborted, then what would have been aborted? Aborted. If David had been aborted, then what would have been killed? A product of conception? No, what would have been killed was someone who had been woven in his mother's womb, whose inward parts and organs had been created and fashioned by God, and it would have been murdered. David also said in Psalms 22, verse 9, yet you are he, talking about God, yet you, God, are he who brought me forth from the womb. You made me trust when upon my mother's breast. Not only in the womb, but when David was a helpless baby, he trusted his mother. Likewise, David trusts God. Verse 14, David says, I will give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully. Fearfully means with reverence. When I look at what I was when I was made, I feel reverence for God. I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful is like marvelously made. It is a wonder and a marvel to look at David, even when he was in his mother's womb. Here's what Adam Clark says about being wonderfully made. The texture of the human body is the most complicated and curious that can be conceived. It is indeed wonderfully made, and it is withal so exquisitely nice and delicate that the slightest accident may impair or destroy in a moment some of those parts essentially necessary to the continuance of life. Therefore, we are fearfully made. And if you think about that, that was 19th century English, but if you think about the parts of the human body, when you look at all those movies and pictures of what goes on inside of us, all those medical pictures, it is incredible that the average human being is able to function because of all the working parts. Incredible. Has to be a God. Just look at that. I remember one time I saw a YouTube video about some Christian apologist who was debating an atheist, and he had a certain amount of time. The atheist finished his nonsense, and then the Christian got up and just put a film or picture of the inside of a human being and just sat down. And that was how he spent his 15 minutes of time arguing for God. I thought that was pretty effective. says, are you telling me, atheist, that what's inside of a human being is just the product of random chance, the fizzing of molecules? Please, don't make me quote that verse to you, that the fool in his heart says there is no God, because you got to be doggone dumb to think that this happened by random chance. David finishes up verse 14 by saying, wonderful are your works, namely the making of David. David is considered the work of God, and my soul knows it very well. He obviously does. He's expressed it so well that he knows that God has made a wonderful creation. Verse 15, my frame was not hidden from you. In other words, when David was in his mother's womb, where it's dark and secret in there, but God, he knows everything. He sees everything. He saw David hidden in the womb. When I was made in secret, again, in the womb, that's a secret place. Nobody can see in there. They didn't have ultrasounds back then. Even with ultrasounds, you don't really see too much. And skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. Now, wait a minute. How can David be wrought in the depths of the earth? He says in verse 13, he was woven in his mother's womb. Well, the depths of the earth is a metaphor for the mother's womb, because if you're deep in your mother's womb, you might as well be deep in the earth, because nobody can see you in there. The NIV Study Bible says that depths of the earth is a metaphor describing the womb. That's verse 15 and verse 8. David had said, even if I'm in heaven or in Sheol, you'll see me. Sheol is in the depths of the earth too, so he's still carrying out that same idea of you can't hide from God no matter where you are. John Gale says this same phrase, depths of the earth, this same phrase is used of Christ's descent into this world, into the womb of the Virgin, where his human nature was curiously wrought by the finger of the Blessed Spirit. Gale quotes Ephesians 4:9, which says, now this expression, he ascended, what does it mean, except that he also had descended into the lower parts of the earth? Now, Gill's opinion is one opinion of several. Some people say the lower parts of the earth is just talking about the earth. He descended, he came onto the land. I tend to think Gill's right, though, that that's what Paul meant in Ephesians, was that Jesus descended into Mary's womb. David used the phrase depths of the earth to refer to the womb. Why not Paul? Paul, of course, is familiar with the Psalms, I'm sure, being a Hebrew rabbi. Verse 16, David says, your eyes have seen my unformed substance. In other words, God sees into his mother's womb and sees him before he's completely put together yet. And in your book were all written the days that were ordained for me. Oh, does God write in a book what we're going to do and we're now robots? No. As the NIV Study Bible says, that does not mean we're robots. But what David is talking about is God's best wishes and intentions for his people. He's saying, you wrote down all the good stuff you were going to do for me in this life. Now, of course, that means that if we choose evil, we end up not experiencing good things. And, of course, whatever we do, good or bad, is ordained by God, because on the compatibilist view of God's sovereignty and human free will, we do everything freely, but that is perfectly compatible with God's decree and his ordination, his predestination, if you will. So David says, in your book were all written the days that were ordained for me, when as yet there was not one of them. In other words, God had plans and intentions for you before you even out of your mother's womb. Again, think about the abortionists who go around screaming, get your hands off my body. Think about that. These people are so divorced from the will of God, they have turned their back on God, and then they turn around and shoot him the bird every day of their lives. They are accumulating for themselves wrath beyond measure. They are fools. They are blind. Thank God there's people that have done that and have repented and become Christian. There's a lot of people who have done that. I read somewhere that most of the people in the pro-life movement are people who, women who've had abortions and realized they'd been lied to. And that most people who are in favor of abortion now are men who don't want to have to deal with the responsibility of raising a child, but they want to have the fun of free sex. We move now to Psalms 139, verses 17 through 24, and we will be finished with our exposition of this psalm. David continues, how precious also are your thoughts to me, O God! How vast is the sum of them! If I should count them, they would outnumber the sand. When I awake, I am still with you. Oh, that you would slay the wicked, O God! Depart from me, therefore, men of bloodshed, for they speak against you wickedly, and your enemies take your name in vain. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? And do I not loathe those who rise up against you? I hate them with the utmost hatred. They have become my enemies. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxious thoughts, and see if there be any hurtful way in me, and lead me in the everlasting way. Now we have a translation issue in verse 17. The NASB says, how precious also are your thoughts to me. In other words, thoughts about David. They're precious. T to David. They're dear. They're valuable. Now, the American Standard Version, the KJV, the Darby Translation, the New American Bible, God's Word, all say precious also, but the Holman Christian Study Bible has a one-off translation. God, how difficult your thoughts are for me to comprehend, how vast their sum is, how difficult, not how precious. But the Holman Christian Standard Bible margin says the word should be precious, how precious are your thoughts. So we'll go with precious. How precious are your thoughts to me, O God? How vast is the sum of them? If I should count them, they would outnumber the sand. And of course, if you count the grains of sand, you're going to be busy for several eternities. This is an example of Hebrew exaggeration, very good poetic effect. God is thinking about David an awful lot. When I'm awake, I'm still with you. So God was with David while he's sleeping, and then when David wakes up, God's still there. And then David starts some imprecations against his enemies. That's one thing I've noticed about David's Psalms. He's always calling down hellfire and damnation on his enemies. Does it all the time. He's the master of imprecatory psalms. And I've gone over this many, many times in the previous audios, but let's just say this. David is a king. He has a right and a duty to wreak justice upon the enemies of God, because the enemies of Israel were also the enemies of God and also the enemies of the human race. And it was his business to take care of them. And so there's nothing wrong with David as king to try to destroy the enemies of God. Now, if David was just doing this out of personal revenge because he was piqued because an enemy had stolen something from him or put him in prison for a while or whatever, that's one thing. That wouldn't be good. But he is the magistrate chosen by God to lead the people of Israel, and it's his duty to hate those who hate God and to slay the wicked militarily. For the enemies of God speak against you wickedly, David says in verse 20, they take your name in vain. Now, either that means profane swearing or false swearing. And I tell you, taking God's name in vain has gotten so bad in my American culture, I even hear Christians saying, oh my God, I said, if I hear that again, I think I'm going to spit. God's name is holy. It is not to be taken in vain. But of course, if you're an enemy of God, you will do that. And people do that all. Oh my God. Oh my God. You hear that all the time. It's disgusting. Verse 21, David says, do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? Now, there's that problem word, hate. John Gill says that hate here just means David hates the person's evil works. He doesn't hate the person of the wicked. He loves the sinner and hates the sin, to put it in New Testament language. This is what Barnes says, the American 19th century American commentator, Albert Barnes. He says, the word hate here, as applied to them, as applied to the enemies, must be understood in the sense that he disapproved of their conduct, that he did not desire to be associated with them, that he wished to avoid their society and to find his friends among men of a different character. That might have to do with translation from the Hebrew, too. I don't know Hebrew well enough to know the connotations of hate. I was confronted with this in China when I would listen to Chinese people use English and they would say, I hate her. Or I hate him. And I knew they didn't mean that. They meant they were displeased with them. And they were using the word too strongly, because when you go from one language to another, it's hard to know the emphasis, the shades of meaning that you put on a word. And it could be that the Hebrew here does not come forth as strongly as the English does. I don't know that. I'll put it on my theological do list. It is also possible, I speculate, that David does hate the person because he's not acquainted with New Testament grace yet when Jesus says to love your enemies, not hate them. Now, of course, Jesus did mean let your enemies run all over you and destroy you and to rob banks and rape women and children. No, that's not what he meant. He meant don't take revenge on people. But at any rate, the problem of the imprecatory Psalms, of course, is a difficult one. I've satisfied it in my mind by saying, judicial punishment, yes, sir, go for it. Personal revenge, oh no, don't do it. Verse 23, David says, search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxious thoughts, and see if there be any hurtful way in me. Now, David there is asking for something that all Christians should ask for. My heart is confused, complicated, devious, deceptive. So, God, you search me, and you tell me what I ought to be thinking, and you show me where I have rationalized and where I hide my sins and coat my sins with a moral veneer when I should be repenting for those sins. You tell me how I should think, God. Don't let my mind think about how I should think. You tell me how I should think. Verse 24, see if there be any hurtful way in me, because when we have thoughts that are not God's thoughts, they always hurt us. They're never right. I am 71 years old as I speak, and I can think of thoughts that have hurt me because my mind just goes the wrong way. And I'm constantly having to say, please, God, help me quit thinking that way because it's not right. That's once the wrong thoughts have been revealed. Of course, there are some thoughts that it takes a while for God to show you what it is that you're thinking wrongly. David says, lead me in the everlasting way. Everlasting is our popular word, holam. It can either mean long, 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 long time, so lead me in the way as long as I live. Or it could be, lead me in the eternal way, forever and ever and ever, world without, forever and ever, world without end, into eternity. Either way, the point is that God is everlasting. He will never, ever let you walk off the path and die. So ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with Psalms 139 and prepared to go to Psalms 140. In our next audio, I will discuss Psalms 140, and I will name it, Deliver Me, O Lord, from Evil Men. That's a common theme. So I hope to see you next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.